wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland's listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg produced today's program. We at the Old Mole are dedicated to offering the socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and LGBTQ positive analysis of culture, politics, and current events. This is Women's History Month, but even if it weren't, we at the Old Mole would like to recognize Deb Haaland, not only the first Native American, but the first Native American woman to be appointed to a cabinet post as Secretary of the Interior. Today in our program, Desiree Hellinger interviews Dan Handelman of Peace and Justice Works, Portland Cop Watch, about the 18th anniversary of the U.S. war on Iraq and the ongoing struggle to get the city of Portland to withdraw from the Joint Terrorism Task Force. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office is moving ahead with the criminal investigation of Donald Trump for unlawful business practices. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker in their Left on the Law segment talk about the case and why it's important for the government to prosecute Trump. Up first on today's program, Bill Resnick interviews Elliot Young and Taji Chesimet, co-chairs of the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing. They'll be discussing replacing police as first responders to the problems of houselessness, mental health emergencies, school disorder, minor drug use, and violence prevention. Instead, responding with workers trained in diffusing conflict and supporting people in troubled conditions have found to have far superior results and greatly reduced police violence, especially against people of color. Bill?
Hello, Taji Chesimet and Elliot Young. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you so much for having us.
Tanji and Elliot are co-chairs of the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing. Today they'll be discussing one of their major responsibilities, that is to investigate and prepare a report on the possibilities of replacing police as first responders to a large set of social problems, the problems of houselessness, mental health emergencies, school disorder, public intoxication and minor drug use, also violence prevention. Those are all now police responsibilities, taking up much more than half of their time. Tanji and Ellen will also discuss the potential, as advocated by a majority of community people who have testified before the committee. Those people have advocated that instead of police first responding to all of those people in distress, the city should develop units of workers trained in diffusing conflict and supporting people in distress. Elliot Young teaches history at Lewis and Clark College. Taji Chesimet co-founded the organization Raising Justice. He's very active in youth organizing and local politics. Both have been very active over the years in Portland politics. So, Taji and Elliot, tell us more about your committee and its origins, its growing responsibilities.
Yeah, sure. So, the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing sort of started after the 2012 settlement agreement the city went through. The Department of Justice and the federal government concluded that Portland was using substantial force on people with experiencing mental health crises, especially with tasers, and specifically with the instance of James Chassie and Kendra James and Aaron Campbell led to the necessity for a body like PSEP to exist. PSEP's first body used to be called COAB. Now we are PSEP, and we've been functioning for around 3 years now, working to facilitate dialogue with the community and police about better reform efforts we can do to improve relationships, and all around advising on the body and PPB in its entirety.
Yeah, and then
sorry, Elliot, go ahead.
Why don't you talk about the committees that you have that are working in these various areas?
Yes, the committee consists of 13 members of the public, and we have subcommittees on behavioral health, on racial equity, policy, and policy committee, and we have now created work groups on issues around the Court Patrol Review. So just to clarify, the Court Patrol Review was handed to PSEP by Mayor Wheeler in June as part of his 19-point plan. There was no mandate to reduce the police in that. What has happened is in the feedback we've gotten from the community, there is an overwhelming desire to see the police focus on particular activities such as solving violent crime and to take them out of the business of interacting with people with mental illness or homeless people, and the community has sort of come up with ideas for alternatives to the police.
Yeah, you know, your agents, the PSEP, is what politicians used to call a blue ribbon committee of citizens to investigate and make recommendations on some major issue, except your committee is not dominated by businessmen. It's a blue ribbon group, of course, but of mostly ordinary citizens who are ordinary citizens of an extraordinary species, who are committed to changing the way we deal with so many of these problems. I think it's important to begin with, though, that community-engaged policing is, you're not a program where the model is the police going out to the community and sort of leading them around. One goal is to spy on their neighbors and give information to the police, of course, another way of saying it. You know, that is not the goal of the committee.
So the label community-engaged policing is, I think, confusing. What that means to me is that the community should have a say in how it is policed, and what the role of the PSEP is to provide a channel of feedback from the community to the mayor's office, who's the police commissioner, and to the police themselves, so that we could reduce harm in the community and hopefully improve relations between police and the community. But we're not about setting up neighborhood watch groups or community policing entities, even though the name might be confusing. That's not really what we're doing.
Another thing I would add in there is how a lot of the new work we've been doing with this Truth and Reconciliation has beget the really important question of community engagement and whether community policing is an initiative that has worked or is working, especially when the police do not come with a perspective of trying to learn from the mistakes that they've caused personally as the Portland Police Bureau, or more widely as being part of the policing system. And so it feels really important for PSEP to be a arbiter for some of this change that we aren't seeing with the community initiatives that PPP is doing on their own. It's really important for community members to be standing up and continuously critiquing and pushing for the change that we need to see so that we don't just have community policing under a false reality, which is what we have right now, which is, and dialogue is really just the first step. We need to, you know, work on truth telling more. We need to work on having more authentic conversations about the harms that's been caused. And I don't think we have been having those conversations. And we won't have the change we want until we do.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Parsi Chesimet and Elliot Young, the co-chairs of the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing. They discuss the origins of the committee and its current work, particularly exploring ways of relieving the police of responsibility for responding to complaints about the homeless, for mental health emergencies, traffic infractions, violence prevention, and also, though, creating, not just relieving the police of responsibilities, it's creating alternative services to work with people in serious distress. I saw a tweet from Elliot asking Portlanders to come to the public meetings that you're holding and make written testimony on the issues of how to reduce violence and increase public safety that do not involve more armed officers. So, Tanji, Elliot, give us a sense of the ideas that have been presented at the March 17th public meeting, and also prior testimony, all the written comments you've received, what their essence and the arguments they've made in support of their positions.
Yeah, so there's multiple ways that the community has been involved. One is through this MAP app, which is an online portal where more than 250 people gave comments on what they believe the police should be doing, what they should not be doing, and what are alternatives to the police. We had a town hall with about 70 people, and we've had these work sessions, one of which just happened on March 17th. And so out of these sessions, there's been generalized comments. And at the last meeting, we were trying to hone down on how we could turn some of that feedback into recommendations or ideas for recommendations. And I'll just talk about some of the ideas that emerged out of the last meeting and out of all of this testimony. One is that people in general seem to be advocates of the newly set up Portland Street Response, which is unarmed, not police officers who go out and try to resolve issues facing people living on the streets. And that could include people with mental illness, people who have addiction issues, and people who obviously don't have houses. So the Portland Street Response right now is a very small pilot program. It just has two vans. It's in one neighborhood. It's only been running for a month. We know that this model works because it's based on the CAHOOTS model in Eugene, which takes 20% of 911 calls. And the general sentiment that we've heard from the community is they want to see the Portland Street Response expanded citywide for funding to be increased so that it's possible. And it's not exactly clear how much would be needed. But basically, we shouldn't be waiting a year or more. This is an urgent need. We need to provide the funding and expand Portland Street Response. Taji, why don't you talk about the other issues and recommendations that came up?
Yeah, sure. So we've also been talking a lot about what sort of calls PPB responds to and how they could better handle calls that are more pertinent to what they're best at, really. Like, what are they best at? And that is handling crimes or handling the aftermath of crime. And it really does also allow for us to explore what does it look like to have some of the funding PPB typically spends on court patrol for things like traffic, and where could those funds go if they were not being spent on those things. And so we've also looked into what it would look like if there was a different traffic unit that was unarmed. We also looked into what it would look like to further fund the Office of Violence Prevention so that we could help reduce the gun violence issue that's happening in the city of Portland and really across the country. And those are just a few of the other ones. And we're really excited to just continue to have these dialogues and work towards some of these solutions. And we've really been proud of how collaborative we've been making this with the community, the city of Portland, and even with PPB in trying to make this as much of a process that can work and be harmonious with the current other reforms happening across the city as well.
And I would add that what we're asking for is for the police to focus on the things that the police are trained to do. And this is something that the police have often complained about, that they're acting as social workers on the street, that they're called for every social problem. And so we agree with the police and even with Daryl Turner, the former and now current president of the police union, who made those comments. The police should not be doing social work on the streets. They're not the right instrument for that, and they oftentimes cause further harm. We think it'll be more cost effective and create less harm and be more helpful for the community to create these alternatives to the police to address what amounts to, as you said, a large majority of the calls that the police are currently handling. And so by doing this, we can reduce harm in the community, stop the disproportionate policing of communities of color, and hopefully also end the unfortunate killings by police of people, many of whom are Black or are in mental health crisis at the time they're encountered by the police.
Elliot and Taji, I have one important reservation about the possibilities of the replacement units and on homelessness and mental health problems and also violence prevention. The reservation is that, let's take the case of dealing with homelessness. Seems to me that the units doing that are going to have an enormous amount of trouble and make it impossible to do their job unless we have much more affordable housing, maybe sheltering for as a bridge to permanent housing, much better kinds of sheltering. But without those resources, it seems to me they're set up in a way that they're going to have trouble succeeding and then be the target of the community saying, look, we changed everything, we took the police out of it, and the homelessness problem is getting worse. That would be, of course, the right-wing call. And unless we really get resources, it seems to me that the whole effort could easily fail.
Yeah, this came up at our public meetings that we are focused on first responders, but that we cannot ignore the fact that we need to deal with the larger social network, and we cannot just have first responders out there dealing with people if they don't have a place to send people who are having a mental health crisis. There needs to be funding for services for those people. There needs to be affordable housing, to be drug and addiction services. So the city needs to work with the county and the state and the federal government to massively increase the funding for a social network so that these first responders are able to channel those people to those places. And I like to think about this moment in terms of the $6 trillion the federal government has spent on resolving the COVID pandemic, and think about what would the equivalent amount be in Portland to resolve the pandemic that we have of violence, of homelessness, of all the social problems we have. In other words, it's going to require a massive investment of money into those services. Some of that money may be able to come from the police bureau as we take work away from them and replace them. But realistically, we're also talking about needing to come up with new funds and sources for that revenue. And there are a lot of wealthy people in Portland who certainly could afford to do their fair share helping to create a social network that is able to really help our whole community.
I would also just say that the Portland Street Response really does, it is really trying to take a holistic approach to this issue. So the people that they're working with, the houseless folks, and not just houseless folks, but really just anyone who needs the support that they're providing, they really work to do wraparound services for these folks. So they're trying to do follow-up, they're trying to get them to sobering centers, to housing and to employment. And it is obviously not an easy thing to do, and that's why they need more funding so they can handle more cases. But at the same time, the resources they have are still limited. So, you know, echoing just what Elliot says and the really larger investment necessary to handle the rest of these issues.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm talking to Taji Chesimeth and Elliot Young, the co-chairs of the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing. They've so far discussed how the great majority of police contacts on the street have nothing to do with serious crime. They're mostly about dealing with the homeless. Taji and Elliot have reported on possibilities of responding to all the problems of people in distress, with people trained in diffusing conflict and supporting people in trouble. Taji and Elliot, tell us about how people in Portland can get involved with the PSEP and you folks for developing these reports and recommendations and strengthening the movement to find a way to deal with problems that don't involve armed men who are suspicious on any contact and often demand obedience, and then if it's not given immediately, move into their combat operations. Tell us about how we can support the struggles to, in fact, intervene in much more productive ways.
So PSEP and, you know, the whole entire policing reform movement is very welcoming to new people who want to get involved in this work. And I think it's really important that we build a coalition of a stronger movement so we can continue to push pressure on the city and on PPB to create the changes that the community wants to see. And so we've been really excited to have a lot of community involvement on the work sessions we've been doing on Court Patrol. We also have really just begun starting working on the Truth and Reconciliation process. So anyone who's interested in these things, or even PSEP itself has running alternate positions that you can apply for, and we have an open position that we'll be filling hopefully in March or April. And we really do want as many community members as possible involved in this and in showing up for this. And I know that, you know, we had a great turnout in the summer and the start of a lot of those larger community protests. And even going throughout the year from there, we still had a consistent amount of people wanting to see changes and wanting to show up. And so really anyone and all are welcome to come and support and join and work with us to come up with the solutions that we want to see for our Portland.
Yeah, and I would just add, we're having a work session coming up. I think it's March 31st. If you go to the PSEP website, you can see the announcement of all our meetings. All of our meetings are public. They're all recorded and put on YouTube so people could follow along even if they can't make the meeting. And the plan is that we will come up with recommendations, send it back out to the community for public feedback through the MAP app and in other forums. And then we will finalize those recommendations. The PSEP will vote on them. And then in May, we are intending to bring our recommendations to City Council. So there are many ways to get involved and have your say in what those recommendations actually are.
The City Council sessions on that and their votes and their decisions they make, that's going to become a central moment in contemporary Portland history, because many of the recommendations will be undoubtedly opposed as strongly as they can by the police and their supporters. It seems to me quite likely that it's going to become very dramatic and important. Okay, we're very near the end of our time for today, and there's a looming question that we have to grapple with, but not today. That looming question happens to be a question for all movements and progressive activists, including media people. And that question is, how do we win reforms, like of the police that we've been discussing, how do we win reforms and at the same time not strengthen the very system that's responsible for creating houselessness and recourse to drugs that quiet the despair and pain and that grips so many, including school children who rebel? And then there's the school-to-prison pipeline, if the police are deeply involved in the school at all times. Of course, the answer is not to abandon reform. People want reform. That's where people are active. The answer is to work in reforms in ways that also challenge the system that creates the homelessness and the rest. Surely we must work to replace the police's first responders to 9/11 calls and other calls about homelessness and mental health problems that people are in the streets and the rest of it. And instead replace them with helping and caring people with the capacity to connect with and really help. But at the same time in that battle to replace, we can point out that this reform will go nowhere unless we as a society create more public and affordable housing and also make sure that recovering drug abusers and the homeless are able to work at decent contributory jobs, like all our poorly paid essential workers. But in that better world, that essential work would pay a living wage. Yes, reforms, but reforms that challenge the system, that are fought for and in operation, challenge the system that creates and exacerbates so much human distress. I guess that's my last word. Kanchi Chesimet and Elliot Young, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So long.
Just look at all those hungry mouths we have to feed. Take a look at all the suffering we breed. So many lonely faces scattered all around, searching for what they need. Is this the world we created? What did we do it for? Is this the world we invaded? Against the law, so it seems in the end. Is this what we're all living for today? The world that we created.
This is KBOO Portland. You are tuned into the Old Mole Variety Hour. What can we say but a sorrowful yes to Queen's accusatory question? Is this the world we created? We need to do better. Now, Desiree Hellinger's interviews Dan Handelman of Peace and Justice Works, Portland Cop Watch, about the 18th anniversary of the U.S. war in Iraq and the ongoing struggle to get the city of Portland to withdraw from the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
So my guest today is Dan Handelman, who is a co-founder and longtime organizer with Portland Peace and Justice Works and Portland Cop Watch, and also with the Iraq Affinity Group of Portland Peace and Justice Works. And he also is a longtime organizer with Flying Focus Video Collective. So we're talking today about the impacts of the war in Iraq 18 years down the road, the war in Iraq being arguably the longest war in U.S. history and a close second to the war in Afghanistan. And we're going to be talking also about links to and new developments in the struggle to extricate Portland from the Portland Joint Terrorism Task Force. So the 19th marks the 18th anniversary of the U.S. war on Iraq. According to the National Priorities Project, the total cost of war to U.S. taxpayers since 9/11 is $5.41 trillion. And if you'd like to get a sense of the other services that $5.41 trillion might have provided in the way of free college education, universal health care, public housing, et cetera, do check out the National Priorities Project at nationalpriorities.org. So while estimated deaths among U.S. service people killed in the war in Iraq now total 4,586, nearly 32,000 Americans and countless Iraqis were wounded. Iraq Body Count estimates that deaths among Iraqis total 288,000. That's 288,000. And that number does not include other deaths resulting from damage to critical infrastructure, malnutrition, and illness. And in fact, as early as 2006, a study published in the medical journal Lancet already estimated that death count at nearly 656,000 already by 2006. So Dan, you know, you've been organizing against the U.S. military assault on Iraq going back to the first Gulf War, which is when Peace and Justice Works was founded. What do you see as some of the critical impacts of the war?
In late January, a lot of news media completely ignored something that was in the New York Times, that the United States dropped bombs on Iraq and killed a leader and other members of the supposed Islamic State about a week after Joe Biden was inaugurated, making Biden the sixth consecutive U.S. president to bomb the country of Iraq. So we had George Bush the first, who launched the Gulf War that you talked about in 1991. Then Bill Clinton took over and bombed them in the no-fly zones and pinpoint bombed Baghdad and other areas of Iraq in 1998. And then we had George W. Bush, who started this war and the invasion in 2003. Barack Obama, who then kind of sent a third wave of the war in to fight the Islamic State in 2014. Trump continued that war and decimated the city of Mosul in 2017, and then now Joe Biden's also bombed Iraq. So that's six presidents in a row. I just find astonishing. This is seen as part of the war on terror, even though Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. And people's ignoring this background noise of war that goes on this long is astonishing to me. When we're down at Pioneer Square every week for the Friday Rally for Peace and Justice, people come over and see my sign that says Iraq, U.S. out, and say, we're still in Iraq? Like, people don't even know that America has 5,000 troops there. Well, somewhere between 2,500 and 5,000. Trump told everybody he'd drawn it down to 2,500, but that was just revealed that was not accurate. So, you know, it's just this ongoing issue that it doesn't get addressed. The authorization for U.S. military use of force in Iraq was passed in 2002, and has never been rescinded. So often these continued bombings are, including the bombing in Syria that Joe Biden undertook in February, are explained away by saying, oh, this is part of our authorization to have the war in Iraq, which was to unseat Saddam Hussein, somebody who died nearly 20 years ago at this point. So just, again, it's just continues to numb people to the idea that warfare is never ending.
Yeah, so, I mean, in addition to the human casualties, which obviously are clearly overwhelmingly on the Iraqi side, so in addition to, you know, people who are killed, you know, directly by arms, right, which is the figure of about 288,000, we've also seen a tremendous impact on Iraqi infrastructure. We've seen massive displacement, intensification of violence against women, whose general standard of living has greatly declined as a result of the war. But also we've seen some serious environmental impacts of the war that I think often don't get talked about. And Dan, I think you were in Iraq, I believe, between the two wars, right? And I think at that time you actually saw that there was a tremendous spike in both people who were born with, you know, birth defects, as well as a huge spike in cancer as a result of, it seems, a lot of the chemical contamination and depleted uranium. Can you say a couple words about that?
Well, I think that says most of what I would say, that depleted uranium is basically nuclear material that's no longer usable in nuclear power plants or nuclear weapons, explosive nuclear weapons, but it's stuff that they can use to tip mortar shells and things that are fired out of firearms to make them so they can pierce through metal. And when it explodes, the depleted uranium goes out throughout the environment and poisons the water and poisons the air. And so there's lots of, as you said, birth defects and other medical issues, including probably what's called in this country Gulf War syndrome on American troops that came home being exposed to all of that.
Yeah. And I mean, just to note too, that, you know, the U.S. military is the single largest institutional user globally of fossil fuels. And so I don't know if there's been estimates of the spike in fossil fuel use as a result of this expansive militarism in the Middle East, but certainly it's done tremendous damage in terms of carbon emissions of the U.S. military. Maybe we can transition a little bit also to the issue of surveillance. It's certainly the war has resulted in an intensification of domestic surveillance as well as surveillance overseas. Do you see specific connections between the war in Iraq and the issue of the Joint Terrorism Task Force?
So what I'd say is yes and no, because the United States government has done surveillance on its community members for a very long time, since, you know, the invention of the FBI at least, and was intensified after the 9/11 attacks. But it was actually the Joint Terrorism Task Forces were created writ large across the country in the 90s after the first attack on the World Trade Center, where somebody tried bombing the basement of the World Trade Center. Bill Clinton helped create these Joint Terrorism Task Forces. And we at Portland Cop Watch discovered the existence of the Portland Joint Terrorism Task Force in the year 2000. So even before 9/11 happened, before the war in Afghanistan, and before the war in Iraq, you know, basically these task forces include the FBI and other federal agencies, including some military agencies and local police agencies, including in Oregon, the state police, and a couple of area police, like the Port of Portland police, Multnomah County sheriffs in this Portland area. And we've had a struggle of getting in and out of this task force over the years. A mayor, Tom Potter, in 2005, a former police chief, got us out of the task force till early 2011, because the FBI set up a young Somali immigrant in a fake bomb plot, claimed that we were in great danger and the police needed to rejoin the task force. So then we organized again in 2019 and got Portland back out, ostensibly out of the task force, but the resolution around that allows the Portland police to work with the FBI on a case-by-case basis on cases of terrorism and threats to life, including hate crimes. Now, as we saw in Georgia recently, that hate crimes and threats to life are very commonplace, unfortunately, in our country, but they're not necessarily what people would define as terrorism in the same sense that the initial creation of the Joint Terrorism Task Force meant it, and there are already laws against doing things like that. And there's no reason for that to be in the auspices of a terrorism task force. So we have been pushing to get completely out of the task force. In January, the Portland police presented what's a required annual report to the city council, which is very threadbare in its details, but kind of shows that some of the cases that the FBI turns over to the Portland police have very tenuous at best relationships to any kind of criminal activity at all. And vice versa, where the police turn stuff over to the FBI, and it's not really necessarily any kind of terrorism.
Can I just note, too, that the phenomenon that has been characterized also as terrorism has been sort of various kinds of ecotage, so that even attempts to push back against and have nonviolent blockades of fossil fuel equipment can be, you know, deemed a form of ecoterrorism and might then be investigated in that way.
Right. Well, and, you know, since the Capitol Marauders attacked the United States Capitol in January, there's been a lot of talk about extremists and extremist activity. And while white supremacists and what happened that day are certainly things to be concerned about. There's a whole movement to create new domestic terrorism laws, which are not needed because we have plenty of laws to stop things like people going in and attacking Capitol police officers. We have to really, really cautious about what's going to happen with the people in power now, who are mostly at this point predominantly Democrats in the two chambers of government and the president, as they try to strengthen anti-terrorism laws to be focused on U.S. citizens. Not that it's any better when it's focused on people who are not from this country, but it's just, we don't need to ramp this stuff up now. So the campaign that's been trying to push on getting the Portlanders get all the way out of the terrorism task force, we held a news conference the day before the report was presented to City Council in January, and then we also held a live watch party where we commented while the City Council meeting was going on, live on YouTube, when we kind of inserted ourselves in the corner and giving little pieces of factual information and rebutting some of the stuff that was coming up at the hearing. So if people want to see that, that's at our YouTube page, youtube.com/peaceandjusticeworks.
Yeah, great, Dan. Thank you for that. And I mean, a recurring issue, I think, throughout this has been the lack of city oversight, basically the inability for local city government to get any kind of transparent accounting for how deputized Portland police are operating within the framework of the JTTF.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest, that's one of the reasons that Mayor Potter withdrew from the task force in 2005, because as the mayor, who's the commissioner of police, he could not get security clearance to find out what they were doing, which leads to something that's come up very recently in the news here, too, that the current mayor, Wheeler, wants to deputize officers to combat the civilian-on-civilian shootings that have undergone a huge uptick in the last year. And they're saying that while last year, when the Portland police were deputized for supposedly for one day to deal with white supremacist protest that was about to happen and ended up being deputized for the rest of the year, what's happening with this is completely different. But it's not. It's exactly what you're saying, that once you deputize local police, it makes it a lot harder to figure out how to hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. So I think that's another thing to be concerned about. It's very related to the Joint Terrorism Task Force issue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So all kinds of domestic organizing can be relegated to the auspices of some kind of terrorist threat. I just want to note that historically, back in, I think, 2003 or so, Jack Tafari, who was at one point chairman of Dignity Village, reported that Dignity Village had been under investigation by the FBI through the Joint Terrorism Task Force. So, you know, it's very difficult to know which groups have, in fact, been targeted because their investigations are so secretive. But there's certainly a lot of concerns also from labor that, you know, labor can be essentially also targeted under the auspices of the JTTF. And certainly the Muslim community was heavily targeted.
Right. And certainly historically, that's another thing that, you know, the FBI and other federal law enforcement has sought to undermine over the years. Black power organizers, women's rights movements, anti-war activists, immigrants, and labor movement certainly are all targets of federal spying and infiltration. Well, so, you know, getting back to the issue of the anniversary of the war in Iraq, President Obama actually launched the war on Libya on the 19th of March, the same day as the anniversary of the war in Iraq. So this year marked 10 years since the war in Libya, which tore that country apart, led to a civil war, you know, the rending of limb from limb of Muammar Gaddafi by Libyan citizens, and a fight between different factions that's only now starting to be resolved through negotiations at the UN and a possible unity government being formed. So that's just another example of U.S. militarism and imperialism at work that is also tied to the same anniversary date of the war in Iraq.
Yeah, and just a note, too, that I'm not sure how many studies have been conducted, but I'm thinking of a lecture that Prexy Nesbitt gave in Portland at the start of the war, in which he talked about the relationship between hate crimes and militarism, and that, you know, typically during times of war, and I think this is certainly an argument Martin Luther King made, you know, during times of war, you see an intensification of racism and hate crimes domestically. And so now we're basically putting forth the FBI as the entity to solve the problem of hate crimes that war itself may have helped generate. Martin Luther King talking in his Riverside Church speech about war basically being a kind of poison that injects hatred and intensifies racism domestically.
Right. The only way that a country can successfully go to war against another people is to demonize and dehumanize them. And then that gets turned into a general distrust and sometimes hatred and physical responses to people who are perceived to be from the area that the war is happening in. And that obviously also includes the way that we've been talking about fighting the virus as a war and Trump labeling the virus as a China virus. And then we have all this anti-Asian violence that's happening here in the country. So, you know, they're all tied together.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for those reflections. I've been talking to Dan Handelman today. He's a co-founder and longtime organizer with Portland Peace and Justice Works, Portland Cop Watch, and the Iraq Affinity Group is part of their organizing work. Dan, thank you. Yeah, if people want to know more about your organizing work, where should they go?
Our website is www.pjw.info.
Again, that was Dan Handelman with Portland Peace and Justice Works. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Omaha Variety Hour.
Oh, you tell me that there's danger to this land you call your own. And you watch them build the war machines right beside your home. And you tell me that you're ready to go marching to the war. Oh, I know you're set for fighting, but what are you fighting for? Before you pack your rifle, go sail across the sea. Just think upon the southern part of land that you call free. Oh, there's many kinds of slavery, and we've found many more. Yes, I know you're set for fighting, but what are you fighting for?
This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to the Omo Variety Hour. That was Phil Oakes with another challenging question. What are we fighting for? There are good fights to be fought. War is not one of them. Now our left in the law team, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker, conclude today's program. Manhattan District DA Cyrus Vance Jr. is moving ahead with the criminal investigation of Donald Trump for unlawful business practices. Jan and Mike talk about the case and why it's important for the government to prosecute Trump, as well as what can be learned from earlier political trials of criminally corrupt politicians.
The Manhattan District Attorney's Office scored a victory last month in the ongoing investigation of Donald Trump after the Supreme Court rejected Trump's final appeal to shield his tax record. Well, there's been an endless trail of criminal probes and civil suits lodged against Trump over the decades, but he has so far escaped major consequences. The endless series of dramas featuring Trump seem to have been canceled or at least removed from primetime coverage by his electoral defeat. So, Mike, why should progressive care about the ramping up of the investigation of Trump around tax fraud, particularly given that tax fraud cases are notoriously difficult to prosecute?
Well, it's critical, I think, Jan, for several reasons. One is a big element of Trump's charm and his attraction is his invincibility. The fact that everybody has tried and no one has ever succeeded. The fact that he could, as he said, shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and not have to pay any consequences for it.
Much less pay any taxes.
Exactly. His whole business enterprise is saturated in criminality. It always has been. Tax frauds. He's paying his daughter $750,000 in consulting fees in a year in which she's also retained as an employee. Just blatant fraudulent stuff. That's how he pays a total of $750 in taxes, federal taxes, 3 years ago. Far less than you or I or people we know, because he's got these phony losses. And I think it's important for lots of reasons. For one, just it's important to deter people. If you think that impunity is a reality, if there is a culture of impunity, then nobody will feel constrained to follow laws that really get their teeth from the threat of punishment. I mean, some crimes like murder. The reason you haven't gone out and killed anybody is not really because there's a statute against murder. It's just, that's not who you are. It's not how you define yourself. But the reason you don't go 90 miles an hour down Highway 5 when you're going to Ashland, or if you're going over the mountain to 26, is because you don't want to get a ticket. And the reason we pay our taxes grudgingly, we go up to the edge, but is because that we could be busted and inconvenienced and maybe even suffer financial losses.
But, you know, staying with your analogy or your metaphor, is Trump traveling at 100 miles an hour, careening around a mountain pass, set new thresholds for even what is corruption? I mean, the major banks have shut their doors to Trump, and that's a big part of his relying on foreign investors, including Russian investors, to buy his properties overvalued. But it seems there's some potential here for something like the Keating Five, where there were a bunch of senators after the savings and loan scandal who were mildly reprimanded for corruption around schemes related to that Lincoln Bank, I think it was.
So, remember, Jen, Charles Keating went to jail. Charles Keating did time. He was a fraudster on a massive scale, just like
Trump. Politicians who were implicated in that corruption came out pretty unscathed, including John McCain. I mean, Trump is so larger than life, corrupt and horrible. I think there's no question about the importance of bringing him down. But there's a lot of virtue gathering around low-level corrupt politicians who are perhaps eager to have him come down. But I'm always suspicious of other people on the stage of these dramas.
The phrase you just used, the fact that saying that he is larger than life, is precisely why it's important that he be prosecuted. He now has created an image that has saturated everyone, saying that he's basically outside. He's larger than life. That means he cannot be put in jail. And that's the serve time in a room the size of a ping pong table is something that did happen to dozens of people doing frauds in the 80s. When the savings and loan companies first began to organize their home loans in ways that could be exploited. And that had a deterrent effect that lasted a while. And it's true, they didn't get everybody. The senators who had taken lots of corrupt money were mildly reprimanded, as you said, but they got somebody. The risk remains. The fact that they got people meant that everybody else had to watch themselves, had to be careful. And that's a critical part of maintaining an orderly society, is having people being conscious about staying in lanes. And it's not necessary to have perfect justice to create a society or a social order where people generally behave and generally pay their taxes. If they don't, you have societies like Mexico, where like something like 12% of the officially owed taxes are actually paid. And we do better in this country. It's known in other parts of the world as being remarkably law-abiding. And one of the chief elements of that is to take people who think they are larger than life and bring them down to size.
Well, let's talk a little bit about tax fraud and what Cyrus Vance Jr. and the Manhattan DA's office is confronting. I mean, they have some very talented people unpacking all of this and going through these records. I mean, there's one issue that many of the aspects of the investigation won't be public, so that what I think the public benefits from often, it's like the Mueller report, as long as things are kept close to the vest of those involved, there's all of this heightened expectation for the revelatory moment, often that provides very little. So it seems like part of what's important about criminal cases is the court as a stage for public discourse, public education, why there's so much anti-tax, you know, sentiment in this country. Like, for the wealthy, it's not just the only thing you can't escape in life is death and taxes. The only thing you can't escape is death. I mean, they escape taxes all the time. And when it was revealed that Trump paid almost no federal taxes over a long period of time, that did not affect his popularity. In fact, it seemed to bolster
that's right.
him. So other than the obvious that this is an exceedingly corrupt person who's worked the system and a symptom of the most pathological side of capitalism in this country, what about these cases can unfold in a way where we can kind of affect the public discourse around tax?
Well, the trial is essential because you're right. Right now, it's all completely secret, and it will only be revealed if there is a trial. Nobody likes to pay taxes, and everybody gets up near the edge, and sometimes we spill over a bit. But we all recognize at the same time that without taxes, we have no government. We have, of course, the things we don't like, but we also don't have streets and schools and all the things that we do like. And taxes are a critical part of any successful society. And Trump's evasions have been of a kind that can be brought down if we do it right. And Cyrus Vance has the money and the talent to do it. The Manhattan DA's office has more money than any other DA's office in the country. They have forensic accountants who can digest a million pages with high-powered supercomputers. Trump's taxes are all on a hard drive that are now in a room that's got copper ceiling. It's guaranteed to prevent any sort of radio.
It's Common's tomb.
Exactly. And I think that a trial that would bust Trump for tax evasion, and he does scandalous tax evasion. He will say that his office building is worth $100 million when he's putting it up for collateral to get loans, and he's living now on borrowed money. He will say it's worth $2 billion when he's paying taxes. He does what good crooks do, in that he does not leave fingerprints anywhere. He does not have an email address.
Right. Or he apparently doesn't takes minimal notes. So what many people viewed as his sloppiness and his lack of professionalism is part of how gangsters operate, right?
Exactly.
People pay betrayal. It wasn't just that he was too stupid.
Exactly. He was trained by Roy Cohn. He's a gangster through and through, and he knows not to give speeches, not to write stuff down, not to have an email address. He has other people send texts from their phones.
Yeah.
He's a master at bringing people in by offering them stuff and saying, well, you need a better place to live now, he'll say to an investigative reporter who gets too close, and offer an apartment. And then you're on the hook. He's really good at all that stuff. And now there's people who are also really good, who I think are capable of taking him down. And I think it's really good to shatter that shield of invincibility, not only because he's Donald Trump with the history that we've all lived through that's burned into us, but also because nobody should be able to be larger than life. Nobody should have this aura of invincibility about them. And to be able to then act as he has acted around women. I mean, he's got 26 suits of sexual misconduct, and he pays them off. You know, his monies that he paid off Stormy Daniels with, he defines them as legal expenses because he gives the money to Michael
right.
Cohen to take them over. They're payoffs.
Yeah, the despicable sexual behavior and his misogyny and, you know, grabbing women, and all of that seems to have captured more interest. Of course, it gets forgiven every day, as we see, and we'll see with Cuomo. But the real estate industry, how Trump operated in the real estate industry, seems to also present a kind of systemic issue with Trump's corruption. It's not just that he's a bank robber gangster holding up banks or seizing properties. He has operated by very liberal exemptions to real estate development projects, apparently. You know, after the Patriot Act was passed, there were some more restrictions on foreign investors in U.S. properties. But after intensive lobbying efforts by the real estate industry, a lot of those were suspended or softened. So Trump came in, you know, operate in a world that's notorious as a kind of shell game for money, including money laundering. What are the chances of some of these broader, more systemic forms of capitalist corruption in real estate coming to the fore in the trial versus the uniquely despicable nature of Trump himself?
That's the foundation of his empire. It's his dad, basically, who built up a series of real estate hustles, real estate projects, and blends thereof. They've been criminal from the gate. They simply don't pay people who work for them on a random basis. And they make the same sort of calculation that Ford Motor Company did with the Pinto, in that if they were to improve the rear end design of their car so that people's lives would be saved, it would cost them more money than it would if they had to pay out occasional settlements to the families of dead people. And Trump figures if he doesn't pay people, he's done these kind of calculations where he'll violate the law, refuse to pay or conform to agreements he's made. And the monies he will save is somewhat more than the inconvenience, hassle, and lawsuits that'll be brought by it.
Well, yeah. You've convinced me there's something important here to pay attention to. Trump has a unique capacity to mesmerize people. I think if we can also broaden the stage and look at all of the enablers and the systemic aspects of how he's been able to operate, then
by getting Trump, you will broaden the stage, because of necessity, you'll have to understand the real estate hustles and the tax hustles, which people do. And by arresting and convicting him, then that will have a positive effect in every direction, more than convicting almost any other single person.
Okay. So we'll see. We'll continue to follow this. Thanks. This is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking today on The Left and the Law about the investigation of former President Donald Trump for tax fraud.
And that concludes our program today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Thank you to Prisha Kohlberg, who produced today's program. Also a big thanks to all our regulars and their guests, Bill Resnick and guests Elliot Young and Taji Chesimet, for their discussion of replacing the police as first responders in many social situations, and to John Nelson, who edited the piece. Thanks to Desiree Helligers and guest Dan Handelman for reminding us of the insanity of our forever wars. And thanks to Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for updating us on the possible fate of the criminal Donald Trump. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. This is KBOO Portland.